this is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. My guest is Jillian Nymark. She's a veteran science journalist and author of adult and children fiction. Jill's a former contributing editor at Discover Magazine. She's also written for Scientific American, Science, Nautilus, Ion, New York Times, NPR, Quartz, and Psychology Today. She published the adult nonfiction book, co-authored with bioethicist Stephen Post, PhD, Why Good Things Happen to Good People. She has also written 5 children's books and 1 novel, Blood Song. I really like talking to her in this time of when really we feel like things may be not so optimistic and difficult to find good things to talk about. We had a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks, Jill, for coming on today.
I'm delighted to be on.
No, it's good to meet you. It's the first time we've had a chance to talk. Everybody seems like a legend until you get to talk to them, and it makes me nervous always. So thank you.
Thank you.
There is never a better time to speak with you. You've spent so much of your career, or at least some of the things that I've researched, talking about resilience. And resilience isn't necessarily in everybody's vocabulary on a normal time, but during the middle of a pandemic, it feels like it's on all of our mind.
Right.
Can you tell me how your thoughts have evolved about resilience over time, and then maybe how it leads into whether it's different for us all now?
Well, sure. I think, you know, my interest in resilience to some extent was personal, because I felt I had a somewhat challenging childhood. And then I also had undiagnosed celiac disease from age 9. And so I had a lot of symptoms that nobody could figure out, and a lot of, you know, sort of health challenges that took a long time to figure it out. And finally, I figured it out in my 40s. So that was an incredibly long time of challenges that were sort of mysterious. And so, you know, when you have kind of ongoing challenges, you need to let it not overwhelm you and not become the sort of hub of your self-definition and the hub of your existence. And you need to sort of put that sort of gravitational center of yourself elsewhere, you know, in something that you have autonomy over. You have, I don't want to say control, because control is always limited in life, but you feel in charge of, you feel you can make a difference, because that's one of the key things to resilience. And actually, on a related note, optimism is not necessarily happiness, but the feeling you can change things. So I think, you know, part of resilience is feeling I can change my situation, even if that means that I change where I stand in regard to it, and I focus on other things that bring me joy and gratification. Am I making sense?
Yeah, and actually there's so much there. The thing that came to me, you had from the time you were very young until you said 40 before you were diagnosed with celiac.
Right.
You've spent a lot of your career digging into science and different scientific issues. Did you try to solve and diagnose yourself and figure out what's going on?
Yes, you know, it's really interesting. I think this brings up a whole nother area. I think I intuitively knew long before I scientifically accepted that I probably had celiac, since my aunt, my maternal aunt, had celiac sprue as a child. Okay, so I knew it was in my family. And I knew that whenever I ate wheat, I didn't feel good. But, you know, it wasn't until I remember I was researching and I came across an article that said you can't have any gluten. You can't just have a little. In my own mind, I thought, well, I won't eat much gluten and I should be okay. But you can't have any because it triggers the whole autoimmune process. And it was like a light bulb went off. So, you know, I went to get an antibody test and I was positive. So I went off all gluten, and all kinds of longstanding mysterious problems cleared up, including that I was sort of diagnosed with early osteoporosis. You know, everything, you aren't absorbing your nutrients to make strong bones, to all kinds of things, have a strong immune system. So definitely I was drawn to science partly that way, partly because of my own issues. But also, science is one of my ways of being resilient, understanding science, understanding the world through science, understanding right now, for example, I saw a beautiful description for children of a child saying, well, mommy, why did God make this virus? And she said, well, God made the world. God wanted the world to be creative, to be sort of openly creative. The reason we have so many incredible things on this planet, so many different expressions of life, is because there's a sort of a creativity inherent in life. But sometimes that can lead to, a virus jumping a species, right? You don't go into that much with kids, but I think that's, for example, how I look at the pandemic. I zoom out to viruses and what they've done for us in evolution, because we have retroviral sequences in our bodies, right? From past plagues way, way back in our forebears and evolution. And the genes we kept from those gave us the placenta. We don't sit on eggs because of a virus. So, there are aspects of our immune system that work because of viral fragments. So when it's very hard to be going through this now. It's incredibly hard for us all. And it's hard in this kind of, it's not a big explosive thing. It's just dragging on and on and on, right? But every time I get upset about it, I try to remember what viruses have meant to us in evolution and see the beauty inherent in viruses in a bigger way. So that's where resilience comes from. It's like you're moving your perspective. You're moving your locus of control. You're moving to a place where you can handle it and understand it. And so science, science is a gateway to that. That's really profound, right? I mean.
Well, yeah, but and for sure. I mean, I think that this sort of taking control, I mean, I know you, as you said, control may not be the right word, but getting away from the chaos, at least in order to sort of have an experimental or discovery method about this, it can bring something different to it, for sure. I had no idea I'd go down this path, but when you talk about historical value of pathogens or viruses in general, I think about things like junk DNA. You know, people talk about this.
I don't think that there's junk.
And that's what I was about to say is that what occurred to me, but it's historically people have referred to it this way.
We don't know what it does yet.
Clear understanding of what it is. We call it junk. It doesn't have there is no. But I look at your work and and I may be saying this wrong, so correct me. You seem to focus on, I don't know if it would be, sort of self-reflective life, but also a little bit about legacy and a little bit about the past in this sort of interesting way that I'm wondering if you see something between a personal sort of past and future for humans, the way that we would see it within a DNA structure or within the evolution of a microbiome.
Are
you interested in, tell me about legacy. I mean, tell me about what you think about, what good we do now in the future, affects the future. What happened in the past? Where do we fall in this continuum and how should we look at it?
I was thinking this morning, we truly are part God, part devil. I mean, humans have the most incredible capacities. We're only, 150,000 year old species. I mean, it is just unbelievable that I'm talking to you on Zoom right now. You know, it's just like unbelievable what we've been able to do. And we're the only species with foresight. No other species really can plan for the future. Well, that's not quite true. Birds plant seeds for the next winter, but you know what I mean. There's the level of ability to engage and plan. And given all these capacities, it is astounding to me that we aren't doing a little better. But I remember in 1999, I went to a lecture at the Museum of Natural History with Lynn Margulis, who is the late Lynn Margulis. She was an incredible biologist. I believe she should have won Alaska and a Nobel Prize because she understood that mitochondria were once these organelles inside our body that in every cell that create energy were once free-floating bacteria, and that our cells are due to a merger of two bacteria. That, as an aside, Freeman Dyson once said to me, the physicist Freeman Dyson said, it was a fight to the death, almost a death, that resulted in this merger that created all the complex life on Earth, right?
Fantastic way to say it.
You know, she put up a slide. This is like, I never will forget this. She put up a slide of slime mold in a Petri dish. And she showed me this later in her lab. And she said, as long as you give it nutrients, it will just grow. It will grow over the sides of the dish. It will not stop growing. And it's like a super organism. And then she put up these slides that look similar. And she said, what do you think this is? And she said, it's all the lights of human, all the lights at night from human, you know, all the lights from humans, you know, except for the seas, it's dark. And it looks similar. And it's like, I really feel like, you know, we're in a real struggle because the evolutionary urge to reproduce and the things that are so written to every cell of every organism on Earth are kind of at war with this foresight, this beautiful ability we have, this, you know, to plan. We could plan our way out of this right now. You know, we could shift to green energy. You know what I mean? We could do things that would save so much pain and suffering. And it's really perplexing that we struggle so hard with it, I think. What do you think?
Yeah, I find it, I think our foresight seems to be, and I think the pandemic has made me realize this a bit more, limited to less years than I thought, right?
Okay, so that's a good way to put it, yeah.
I mean, you know, somebody said to me recently that is a huge environmental activist and was concerned that his career may it be wasted. He said, if we can't even worry about the potential death of one generation during the pandemic, how do we expect humanity to worry about the distant future, even if that distant future is 50 years?
Right.
And that was a depressing thought. I tried to immediately get him over this, saying, you know, science and technology have found these, you know, very quick solutions sometimes that go beyond what the will of a general people and our ability to have foresight is. So I try to bring some optimism into this, but actual human foresight, I'm not sure right now. And the pandemic's really making me think about this. So I'm not sure. You know, I don't. Do you feel differently now than you did before the pandemic about this issue?
Well, there's a difference between knowing something in the abstract, seeing it with climate change, for example. It's not that hard to make changes to lower your carbon footprint, and yet people won't even do it. But there's a difference between that and seeing it displayed in such vividness, you know, seeing sock someone in the face because they said wear a mask. You know, I didn't expect it to be so extreme and violent. And I guess I feel that they're not really socking that person in the face. They're socking the virus in the face. They don't know who to be angry at, you know, and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, and that there is something interesting to that, that we had this recognition of racial injustice come at the same time. It's a directed anger that probably we should have had for a long time.
Right.
But maybe a recognition of long-term trauma as a society versus a short-term trauma that we can't yet grasp or something like that.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I'm curious about what you think about this as a traumatic event and whether there will be sort of a post-traumatic event surrounding it.
Yeah, well, I do think it's a traumatic event, but it's a very amorphous one in that most of us are not in the hospitals And so we can talk to the doctors who are on the front lines, who, you know, will say there were stretchers in the hallway, but it's kind of, we're walking in, I'm walking down the street here in Georgia and it's peaceful and pretty, right? So there, and I'm told to, and I do wear my mask, I'm very careful. So I'm living an altered existence, but I'm not hearing, say, bombs go off like in wartime London or whatever, you know? And I'm not, we don't have the kind of gruesome deaths we saw in the AIDS epidemic where, you know, we'd see the Kaposi sarcoma and people wasting away and it was absolutely horrific. So it's hidden from us in some way. So the trauma is like a slow starvation diet. We are utterly deprived of something that is critical to us, which is social life. I had never really thought about how we are just the same as ants or bees. We are a completely social species. We can't thrive alone, you know, and we're all in this aloneness now. So I think that the trauma is going to be long-term, because if we get a vaccine that is fairly effective, and I've been talking to a wonderful scientist who I wrote about in April, and she said, you know, we really only need about 65% herd immunity to conquer this. We don't need 80 or 90%, which is very encouraging because some people aren't going to take the vaccine. But once we return to a more normal existence, even if there's little flare-ups of this virus, the way smallpox took forever to be eradicated, I think, you know, it took a long time in the developed world. We won't just eradicate this. But even at that point, I think there's going to be a lot of PTSD, a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder, and people are going to have to grapple with it. You know what I'm saying? But it's not so obvious right now. What do you think?
Yeah. I think that's right. That I think your AIDS comparison is a really interesting one, because, you know, I live in New York, and yeah, you know, I worked in the arts at the time. So people, your community was dying. You saw the suffering, and yeah, people are dying, but the people that die of this, and it's more, die very quickly. So it's easy for us to erase what that was like. Right. You know, you have this walking hypoxia, and, you know, you have this thing that, you know, oh, I just saw somebody, they seem fine. Now there's a trauma with losing a loved one, but the suffering is a very different sort. I find that really interesting.
You know, when, was it Maya Lin who created the Vietnam Memorial in Washington? And it wasn't until you walked that memorial that you felt the weight of all those deaths. You know, it's hard for us to feel, and the New York Times had that incredible front page when we had, 100,000 deaths.
Yeah.
I guess we're visual species. We need that kind of reminder. So, you know, we're living this way, and in some ways we're incredibly lucky. And it's so fantastic that I can talk with you like this. Like we're so lucky to have technology. We're so lucky to have science to be working on these vaccines, but it's still just incredibly painful that you can't, who would think it would be so painful that you can't drop in the bar for a drink with your friends or just sit at a sidewalk cafe? Who would think that that was so critical to our lives, but it
guys,
was.
Well, if somebody would have told me I couldn't drop into the bar, I would have known it to be critical. But like, I would have that foresight, but I get your point, to the point that I almost think that it's a bit of a trap to think that we're okay, right? That because you and I can have this conversation, we started before recording saying, well, guys, isn't it great? We can interview people more and we can speak to people. That's true. But I'm wondering if there's a bit of self-deception in all of this, right? That like, oh, it doesn't actually touch the same thing. I mean, I don't know.
Right. No, I totally agree.
Is there something that is not being released, or is there part of us that is meant to be?
No, I totally agree. You know, we have receptors all over our bodies for touch. And when we are touched, it releases a cascade of really good feel-good chemicals, and that affects our immune system, our mood, and everything. We're deprived of simple hugs, you know. How many times did you hug someone over dinner? You give them a hug. You don't think that that's critical to your well-being, or I didn't, but it was. So yes, we're deprived of essential parts of our nature. And So we just have to do the best we can. Like, actually, I was going to get my friends together to go hug trees, which is considered a sort of a goofy thing to do. But I tried it and I was like, oh, this feels actually really good. Just embracing this living being, you know, a tree. And maybe we could all do that together, because in Israel, that's what they started doing. And how do we work our way around this, you know? And we're just going to be strong, you know, and by the end of 2021, Bill Gates says we'll have a good, you know, a vaccine will have been pretty widely dispensed. Let's hope that's true, right?
Well, you've said two things that were, I'll say positively hopeful, okay. but you know, I don't know that we have certainty beyond it. You know, the potential vaccine, the dissipation of the virus with a herd immunity of 65%, so that it does.
Well, we'll achieve that with background infection rates plus a vaccine.
Right.
That is a relief to know that even if 20% of the population refuse the vaccine, we're still going to be okay. That's all. Yeah.
Right. So there are two things probably that we could do, but give me another one. Maybe I'm wrong. We could leave this to the experts to create such a thing, right? Because that's what we have to do. I mean, we're not all going to be able to experiment with, messenger RNA delivery systems. and we, you know, or we can trust in an authority like a Bill Gates or an Anthony Fauci or whatever that might be, whatever we consider an authority. Or how much do we say, you know, the power that I have, and I say this because of a book you wrote, Why Good Things Happen to Good People, and some of your other work, how much do we become more stoic about it, or say, I have to change my mental attitude in order to have this kind of advanced mortality, to live longer and to feel better? How much can we do it ourselves when the things we don't have control over, we truly don't have control over?
Right. Well, you know, the first thing you have to do is be honest about how it hurts. You know, you have to be honest with yourself and hopefully be able to talk to a few close friends or maybe a counselor, you know, if you've been seeing one. And then you have to say, okay, what things do I really love? I've been going back. I don't think I did this consciously, but I'm going back to earlier eras of literature. Maybe it's just because there's no pandemic there, but I started reading incredible letters over a decade of the great American poet Robert Lowell and his incredibly brilliant wife, Elizabeth Hardwick. And it was in the 70s and was just completely different era. I was completely immersed in this. Then I went to read her essays, and she wrote an essay about Dorothy Wordsworth and William Wordsworth, and they were just in a unique brother-sister relationship that was very involved, and because of her, he was able to become the poet he was, and they took many walks in nature, and it's just, for me, kind of a true escape, you know, back into something profound that is long before this, and I find, maybe because I'm a writer, that's something that really helps me. And then I actually think I've thought about myself. There's a low-level depression. I have to kind of get cognitive about it. I'm going to reach out to my friend and say, want to sit on your porch and talk and discuss poetry, which I did yesterday. We'll sit 12 feet apart because that's my, like, safe. I feel really safe at 12 feet. I figure even if that person was totally a super shit shedder, they're not going to spread or they're not going to give it to me at 12 feet away outdoors. But, you know, and you have to kind of force yourself because you can get into this low level depression where you're just kind of like, you know, because you can't be spontaneous, you know, so you have to plan, right?
Yeah. No, I don't know why this occurred to me, but we're making very deliberate choices like that. If you're going to see, you know, you're going to see less people probably other than seeing like this. You're seeing me and you wouldn't have seen me. We get to have this conversation. You wouldn't, but we're not going to get to sit together at a cafe for a while, or at least probably. I mean, we may, but doesn't seem. So there's this thought with that is obviously not a new thought with social media, for instance. In a modern era, we tend to live in this what people refer to as the echo chamber. Being around the same people with the same ideas, and that can lead, I think, to an absence of discourse sometimes. Are we more likely now, because we, you know, are kind of forced to reach out and or have this like opportunity to reach out to people we didn't know before, or does it become even more of an echo chamber that I can only choose one person or two people to see in person?
You know, you're probably right, but that's why when you brought up the Black Lives Matter, that was an extraordinary outpouring of, you know, every color.
Yeah.
To support Black Lives Matter and out in the streets and painting, you know, Black Lives Matter on the avenue and people wearing masks and risking potentially getting infected. But if you're wearing a mask outdoors, you can do it pretty safely. So I think, you know, that was kind of really encouraging to see that happen in the midst of all this. And, you know, I don't know. I think we're also going to have to think about ways to do that, whether, I mean, I'd like to see drive-in movies come back where we can, you know.
We have one in the Bronx in New York right now at the Yankee Stadium. We have, there's a few of them around. I can't wait to go. Seriously.
Or, you know, there's the Museum of Arts and Sciences here in Macon. I have to go over and look at it. They created some kind of outdoor amphitheater where you can sit socially distanced and watch movies. And I think just knowing other people are around, even if you can't huddle with them, is really going to be health promoting, you know? So I want to do that. Although the last, I think they showed E.T. So I think it was for the kids. The first one they showed was E.T. But anyway, so I think there are things we can kind of do. I think some cities, you know, New York, aren't you having discussions now about some of the avenues were closed off during this time and people want them permanently closed off to cars so they can create outdoor spaces that are more congenial. I mean, there could be some good city planning that comes out of this, right?
Yes, there could be. We'll see.
We'll see. All right.
But right now it is kind of interesting. They have blocked off a few car spots for most restaurants. So we do go out some, you know, and people do sit outside now. And it, of course, as soon as that happens, they end up shutting it down because people abuse the system and end up crowding into these few car spots. And, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests, just looking at systems and institutions in general lately, I have found kind of encouraging. You know, not taking for granted that small moves or small iterative moves are going to make all the difference, that sometimes you need to do something large. And in times when something large appears to be happening, people seem to do it. You can see that with the vaccine. How long would it have taken? Let's pretend it does end up working.
Well, we have a bunch of them.
It will. I think it will. I think so too. I mean, that was a very negative thing that I should assume. Well, I should say, because so the science of it has proven to be, I think an urgency that it would have taken many more years to get to some of these types of therapeutics and vaccines if it were not for this. The same thing may be for overturning some injustices in the country. It's possible.
Right.
I feel optimistic about that sometimes.
That's good. But, you know, when you refer to the book I wrote with Stephen Post, Why Good
Things Happen, please.
I mean, the whole premise of that, which was all backed up by research, is that giving is good for your health. And I think that's another thing that you have to be creative about now, because you can't, but there are ways to, give to others. I think this podcast that you're doing is a way of giving to others, but that you have to, you know, it always makes you feel better if you can connect with someone in some way and you give them something that they value, because that means you have value. And so it's self-affirming, and yet you've connected. And that's like the essence of why giving is good for you, because you feel valuable and you have connected with someone else. And, you know, so I think that's something else that would be good for us to do. I guess we have to brainstorm creative ways to do it, right? But I think, you know, during this time, if we can reach out to others and help them in whatever way we can, and that's, I think, what the Black Lives Matter that all those protests were a form of giving, really, saying, I'm coming out here to support you, even at risk to myself. Yeah.
That's such a beautiful way to say it. It's less of, it's not just protest, it's giving to those others to know that we're in it together and that I'm going to risk something. It's so different than, I think I really upset my daughter. Maybe it was last year. They had they had a protest for something. I believe it was in the height of the Me Too era, coming together as women and as to support, and they got to, they had these protests, they walk over the Brooklyn Bridge, and they got accepted absentee from school. And I said, that's not a proper protest, you didn't risk anything. So the giving was, it was great because it was something that she could connect with and connect with history and look at things and realize what's going on. But now we do feel in risk in a different way, where a protest actually is something, in ways that...
And just to segue for a second, because I was thinking, so the other thing is my children's book, which is The Hugging Tree. So 30 or so teachers did read-alouds of it over the last few months. And I listened to each one, and there was so much love in each teacher's voice and face. They love their kids. They want them to feel good. And I think, I think of the firemen in 9/11. I think of all the nurses and doctors caring for the COVID patients now, and how much that takes out of them. Some of them go home and quarantine from their families, and the teachers. I've been thinking a lot about the teachers now, because I know some of them going back, buying their own.
My wife.
Your wife is a teacher?
She's a speech pathologist in a school, yeah.
Okay, these are the great givers of our society. I mean, and if there's any way we can appreciate them openly, that's a way of giving back to them, because they are on the front lines, the teachers, the doctors, the nurses, and it's not been figured out for them well enough, so they're having to figure it out for themselves. And, I am hearing stories about teachers and what they're going through. And, they love their students. It's a gift. It's a calling to be a teacher. So, what can we do for them? A local restaurant made them free meals and just delicious free meals and brought them over. There must be, even if we just express on social media or to those we know, I value and honor you. Thank you for doing this. It's important, I think,
I think that last, which is, I don't know if it's, I don't know my neurotransmitters well, if it's oxytocin or serotonin or whatever that sort of, you get a like, or you have neurotransmitter. Is that oxytocin?
Probably, yeah.
People get this for like getting likes on Twitter, getting likes.
Oh, right. Dopamine, probably.
It actually probably is dopamine, if it's short term like that too. But what I've noticed on this issue, and I give with my, I have kids in school, and then I have my wife who works in a public school. It's more that I think that it goes along with what you say, that they think that the politicians, whether it's the Department of Education or the mayor are not recognizing it. Right. So
totally.
And it's
totally, it's totally true. But as regular citizens, we can at least, tell them how incredible. Well,
right. Right. Yeah. And I love how, I think this is with your book, but in general, the idea of giving as an almost selfish act is really interesting.
Right. It is a selfish in the best sense of the word, self-affirming, Yeah. And we all need it anyway. We need to connect like that. So, yeah.
And I also, this connection with nature, I was thinking in New York, you know, I live in Brooklyn, New York, and it's a pretty noisy place and crowded place. In April, it got very quiet, right? And this was sort of the epicenter of COVID. So it was something where you did know, you know, I mean, I was sick with it, but I wasn't hospitalized. But you had neighbors that would pass away. And, you know, we saw, you know, nursing homes that were, you know, 40 people at a time. I mean, it's just horrible. But you could hear birds in New York. Right. And you could, you know, this was strange because everything was quiet. You could hear birds. I was watering plants for the first time in my life. You know, I was like, I cared about these things. And now it's kind of noisy again. And I'm still noticing those birds and those plants. And like, talk about giving. It just occurred to me when you said hugging a tree. It's suddenly giving a plant to somebody means something. Right. And I would have never thought that. That is so far out of where I would think.
Right. Well, you know, in March, we're in an apartment building. We have a balcony. So in March, I've never planted a seed.
Right.
So in March, we ordered seeds and we got these little seed trays and put the soil in because we weren't going to go get plants because it would be inside some nursery. And we were just too scared, right? And interestingly, I was a very impatient gardener. I'm like, what? They're just so little. They get bigger. And then they got bigger. And so we transplanted them. And then every day I would come out and scold them. When are you guys going to get bigger and make me a flower, please? I mean, like, and I didn't know what they were either because I'm totally not a gardener. And so I would post pictures on Facebook and say, hi, mine. What am I growing anyway? And people said, well, that one is a zinnia. You're going to get a lot of color. That one is a vinca. You're really going to like it. That one is actually a sunflower. And now I'd say in July, I started getting a profusion, a cataract of color. I mean, I just had like tons of flowers, including sunflowers. I have yellow hibiscus. Oh, plant something called... what's it called? Cosmos. Did you ever hear of a cosmos?
Yes, just recently. It's so funny you say that.
You and I are inducted into the cosmos clan now.
Yes.
Orange flowers. And, you know, and so I feel like they know they're all there on the terrace together. This could be me imagining it, but I feel like they're all together and they're happy. Oh, and something else has salvia. So then the hummingbird started coming.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
And all of that consciousness at whatever level it exists is free of COVID. It doesn't care about COVID and it's not going to, it doesn't, nothing is, you know what I mean?
So I do.
Go out there and water these plants being a first time gardener and still marvel. And you know, one of the things that is so strange to me that I think synthetic biologists understand this, but how come this little seed turns into a little cosmos and that little seed can grow into this humongous sunflower? Like, I know that there's a scientific explanation, but when you actually watch it, it's dumbfounding. Like, you know, where is it coming from? What genetic material made this one grow 3 feet tall and this one grow 3 inches tall? And why this color versus that color? But anyway, it's like a little oasis of interaction I can have, which you're probably saying you feel the same way with the birds and the flowers. That is like free of all the stress and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly. I mean, if you say you want a gardener, I'm as far as possible. And my wife and my kids, but they've been away for 2 months. They went away for 2 months to France. My wife and kids are French. So I was alone in this too. So I love how you say that you were scolding the seeds for not growing. Like, you wanted them to give to you. This is like the opposite of...
But
then it ends up with this thing with your friends, and there is a giving of ideas and of colors, and how do we find life? So that's really interesting.
Well, you know, it's kind of that human quality of impatience. Like, can I please have my gorgeous flowers now? Can I have... now. I want to go back to a restaurant now. It's very hard for us, right?
Yeah. Oh, God. You know, I'm so impatient. I kick myself over this all the time.
Yeah.
So what are you working on now?
Well,
unless you're very superstitious about this.
I'm not superstitious. Well, one of the things I've done because of this pandemic efflorescence with my children's book is, I've been promoting it somewhat, and I'm going to have, talk about Zoom. I hope it goes well, but I'm going to host a Zoom with about 10 of the teachers who did read alouds from all over, and they're going to share. It's just going to be a sharing kind of session, and we'll just see how that goes. And I actually stumbled on the most incredible teacher, Peter Lamada, who is from Zambia originally, and I'm sure he's in a Title I school over in California. And Ellen DeGeneres actually had him on and donated $50,000 to his school because of how caring of a teacher he is. And he did one of the read alouds. And then I had planned to work on this children's book I started in 2013. That's a middle grade novel. And I may do a vaccine story I've been talking to Ava Lee, who I wrote about for Undark magazine. And in April, she is part of the Red Dawn Breaking Bad, all the top government officials who are not in the Trump administration, you know, who are just trying to work, who were part of Clinton and Obama, you know, they were, and they've been trying to help the cities figure out how to mitigate and the states. So she has some really interesting mathematical modeling of vaccines that's really counterintuitive. That's why I was saying, I mean, depending on the amount of community spread in an area, you know, you have to decide when to, you start with high risk essential workers. You know, that's where you start with the vaccine. And then at some point you have to switch over to the regular population given if it proved effective and relatively safe. And she has some mathematical modeling about when to do that that's really interesting. And that's something that the governments are gonna have to figure out because they will not have 350 million vaccines next year, you know? So, and as I said, it doesn't have to be the way you would as a regular person, just imagine, everybody needs to get vaccinated. It doesn't have to be that way, which is great to know, you know, that if we get about 65% because of the reproduction rate of the virus, if 65% either had it like you did, because I really think you'll have immunity for quite a while, maybe not for decades, but I don't believe it's only months. It doesn't make sense.
So can I stop you at that? And I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt because it's fascinating.
Go ahead. I'm blathering.
What makes you think that? The reason I ask.
Because the B cell, the master B, they remember. I wrote about B cells once and I might get this incorrect, but I think they're generated in the bone marrow. They have long-term memory. Now, it's not lifelong. Like, for example, you get chickenpox and you develop a really good memory for it. But as you get older, you actually need to be exposed to chickenpox in your kids and grandkids again to kind of increase your antibody level temporarily and kind of exercise your antibodies in a way. And then, since we don't do that anymore because we vaccinate all the kids, you can get shingles when you're older, in your 60s or 70s, from the same virus because your antibodies eventually over the decades and decades of your life went down. But, you know, you have that memory and your body can ramp up production, maximal production in days, in a few days. You're not, you know, here, it took you weeks to develop the proper antibodies. You know, you don't, B cells go through evolution in the body just like they divide and they are kind of approximate because they've encountered other coronaviruses and the common cold, and then they have to keep dividing and the better ones win out. It's an evolutionary process. And so, you know, I think they're finding that. I think I've seen articles that
I'm part of some coronavirus working groups and things in DC. Anyway, it's one thing that has been, you know, we've talked about some encouraging things, rapid technological development like vaccines that went faster. I mean, I am generally an optimist about everything, but you know, there's been definitely down moments during this. But what's really disconcerting is that I think we sequenced the genome for that was we sequenced COVID in January,
right?
And it's amazing how we still don't know as much as we should know, and this surprises really top virologists. You know, SARS was 3 years immune to something like this, but you know, most coronaviruses are only a few months, and so it's been, you know, there's this arguments going on about this. That the only reason I ask you is, I mean, certainly it seems very positive about these, you know, the way that this is playing out, but there's still so much uncertainty. And at what point this goes beyond COVID, just do you go from what we talked about early in the conversation of researching your own immunity issues that turned out to be celiac, to researching COVID, or being just hopeful that it will be overcome and being sort of selective? And I'm not saying you are being, but it's well, interesting in order sort of for mental survival that gets to this positive feeling, do you pick the wishful?
Oh no, I actually think that I'm really, 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 really lucky to be a science journalist in a time like this, and that I was incredibly lucky to run into Ava Lee March when she told me exactly what to do, and I do it. And I don't know if anybody, she understood it because she had worked on Ebola and Zika and gone to Fukushima, and she said to me, like I said, I have to go to the doctor sometimes, you know, and what do I do? She said, you wear I've got N95s. I managed to procure them. She said, you have to wear a shield and you have to decontaminate. When you get home, you need to take those clothes off and take a shower and wash your hair. She said and so I just said, okay. And then when I said to her, how far apart do I have to sit outside? She said, 10 feet. I just take her as my gospel because she's a genius. And I said, well, I had 2 feet just for neuroticism or whatever, but you know, so I'll make it 12 feet. But I'm constantly reading the research. That feels like the only way I can figure out how to live.
It's just confusing research, I guess I'm saying, for this particular thing.
It is. You know, I think when they're saying, my feeling is, okay, you had it and you seem to be doing well, but you don't want to assume long-term immunity. Of course not, because if it wasn't, well, who wants to get it again? And then there's something called, you don't know if there's antibody-dependent enhancement, like in dengue virus or malaria, where you get it worse because your body's really pissed off, you know, or whatever. So, of course, you're going to err on the side of caution. But I am pretty optimistic that most of the people who had it will have immunity for, you know, I don't know, a couple years or something. I'm a wish thinker. But if I had had it, I wouldn't bank on that. I'd still take every caution.
My instinct and from what I've, you know, tried to dig in as much is similar, especially when you compare the SARS researchers from the 2003 SARS epidemic, looking at the similarities are enough that 3 years seems kind of right. But, you know, I'm not a virologist or an expert, no matter how much I try to read on this stuff. This makes sense to me. And you know what I've really loved about this conversation and about getting to know you, and I look forward to digging deeper into your work, is that somebody could read the title of some of your books and think that it's very much about, I guess this is where I was going with the previous question, it could seem like a sort of spiritual power, positive thinking type of idea,
right,
which
right.
isn't bad per se, but you are a deep scientific researcher who wants to combine evidence with those unknowns. I think this is very rare now.
I have that sort of mystical spiritual strain in me too. Yeah, but But yeah, let's back it up with science.
Right. That's why I say combining it. It's a,
yeah. No, we were gonna take a trip up to New York in May. So of course we did. But one of these days we're gonna be up in New York and we'll get to sit at a cafe. So
let's do that. Thank you so much, Jill, for talking to me today.
Okay, thank you.